Hi, you guys. This is Richard Sachs again. I'm your host on Lost Arts Radio, and we're honored to get into episode 4 of the series with Joel Skousen this time. We went through the Cold War years last time, and we're going to be getting into more recent period in this session, and we've got more ahead, I think, after that, and we'll get eventually into current affairs and propose solutions to the things that we actually can have solutions to and look at that. And before we get going, and welcome, Joel, I just had one quick question from last time, if that's all right. I won't take long, and if it's too long of an answer that would be required, we can put it off to a later episode. But
all right,
just while it's fresh in my mind from last time, remember that we were talking about the transition from the Soviet Union to Russia and the fact that you've been developing this understanding that ultimately Russia and China are being directed by the deep state under the surface into a position of the U.S. having established itself as the bad guy, them being justified as an attack, that leading eventually, and we'll go into more detail later, of how the deep state and world government takes over prior to it. Its plans after that. I think I have that pretty accurately. And I had at one time ask you in the discussion, what about the positive things that are happening since the Soviet Union changed into Russia? And that may be, you know, food for a later discussion. But my question that comes from that really, you know, basic question is, when did you finalize more or less the basics of your understanding of what the bigger plan was to ultimate World War III? When did that coalesce?
Well, it coalesced really in 1997 when President Clinton signed Presidential Decision Directive 60, which revised our entire nuclear doctrine, military doctrine of nuclear war, where it directed our military forces to absorb a nuclear first strike and then retaliate afterwards. And I thought, you know, this is just suicidal unless there's some other motive here to explain that. And it seems like the light suddenly came on. This is the perfect foil to convince the American people that you've got to join a militarized global government. That's how we get into a global government, a militarized with taxing power, with all the things that Americans refuse to even consider right now, is that if we absorb a nuclear first strike and our military is decapitated, everyone wakes up with an absolute, what do we do now? And the government comes out of their bunkers and say, well, we've got a solution. You know, we join with other Western nations and form a global military to prosecute this war.
Yeah.
And that's what dawned on me, that this is all in order to provoke the absolute need for a third world war. And, you know, I got a hint of an implication that when you talk about the New World Order, the deep state directing Russia and China, no, they don't direct them. They have attempted to build these enemies, and a lot of conservatives, conspiracy theorists, mistakenly assume that because Rockefeller was involved in the Soviet Union and the Rothschilds are loaning them money, that they must be directing them. But there's a difference between supporting them and building them as an enemy and directing them. They don't direct them.
Well, when I use the word direct, I didn't mean like that, because I agree with you completely. I meant like when you're directing a herd of cattle to go through a gate because they have nowhere else to go. And so you build the foundational situation where they come to that conclusion on their own and follow what the deep state intended them to do. Is that?
Yeah, certainly the deep state is creating the excuses and handing Russia and China an excuse by making ourselves the bully of the world. And Putin has used that. Putin has gone to his people and said, the United States is the bully of the world.
Well, the problem is he's telling the truth, you know, according to not the people of the United States, but the government, the shadow government of the United States, which the non-shadow government is obeying, you know, for various reasons of blackmail and bribes and who knows what. But what year was it that Putin took over? I should remember that.
Let's see. Putin took over about in 1993 or something in that area here.
Okay.
So I guess he replaced Yeltsin, And as
right.
and we'll talk about when we get into that period about the phony fall of the Soviet Union, that Putin has met 5 times in the year he ascended to the presidency. Before he ascended, he met with Boris Berezovsky, the Russian oligarch who had a villa in Spain. Spanish intelligence says Putin went in there secretly 5 times and met with Boris Berezovsky before. So he was Putin was a puppet of the Russian oligarchs, and replaced Yeltsin, who had become an alcoholic and was incompetent.
Right.
But eventually Putin betrayed those oligarchs and had them killed or exiled.
And again, I feel guilty taking the time for this, but I wanted to get it in before we move beyond this time period. And my question was, what's confusing to me is that, yeah, what you're saying is being played out, and the U.S. is enthusiastically, you know, at least on the upper levels, playing the part of the bad guy that you describe. But when Putin suggested after the Trump election and even before it, that instead of blowing up the world, and he said this, we form a mutually beneficial alliance of business where we can both benefit our countries. And it's not just that. He's been helping families, resisting religious terrorism, a lot of the social degradation that's happening in the West. He's calling out the media for what it's doing. He wants to be the biggest exporter of organic food. He's trying to keep Wi-Fi out of schools where it would affect children's health, which is something I'm familiar with, and propose this peaceful win-win alliance. Why is all that not real, if that's the case?
Well, you know, Putin is a smart guy. He's got a lot of smart advisor too, and he's playing the West. I mean, for example, the reason he's in Syria was that he sees the U.S. faking their war against terror in Syria, and he says, I can expose that. So yeah. He bombs this convoy of ISIS oil tankers lined up at the Turkish border and says, now this is what you should be doing, United States, if you're serious about fighting terror. He embarrassed the U.S. because, not because he's a good guy, not because he's not intending to take over the West, but he you know, needs to show his people, build up his own stature, show his people that the U.S. government are hypocrites in the war on terror, that they're bullies, that they're intervening around the world. Now, there's a lot of propaganda involved Putin. For example, this whole notion, and a lot of people, because of Paul Craig Roberts, who naively has bought into the Russia's the good guy and the deep state's the bad guy, and many libertarians do too. Even Ron Paul doesn't think that Russia and China are enemies. He takes the position that anything the deep state has to be vilifying has to be good, and that isn't true.
Does Ron Paul not realize what the Chinese government does to its citizens?
I think he does, but, you know, he's taken this libertarian point of view that it's not our affair, and to a certain extent it isn't, except the fact that we're supporting all that by allowing free trade to build up China so that they can build their military arsenal.
Yeah.
You know, it's a complex situation dealing with liberty, and but when you are building up an enemy that has hostile intent, I believe you have the right to intervene and cut off all trade. And you shouldn't have ever allowed the World Trade Organization to accept China in. You shouldn't ever have allowed trade to start with China as someone, because you know they're going to use the profits from that trade to build an arsenal against the West. And that's exactly what they're doing. But now that you have, it would be an extreme hardship. You'd violate all kinds of contracts and cut off, I mean, about 80% of the products sold in the United States, consumer products, are made in China.
Become dependent on that export market, right?
And so now it becomes difficult, if not impossible, as a matter of principle, to do the right thing once you've already got people hooked on. And believe me, the reason the globalists have wanted this over the years is because it masks inflation. You see, you have a certain amount of deflation occurring because of the cheapening of prices through imports of China.
Right.
And it masks the 7 to 9% real inflation rate in the United States and makes it look as if it's smaller.
Yeah, until you try to buy local food or something. But, you know, so that's the substance of the area I wanted to get your input on. And there's a lot to it. So would it be smart for us before we take too much more time on that, to go back to the sequence, the chronological sequence we were following, and then maybe put that in later at a time when you think it fits.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get into this in more detail. There's a lot to cover in the modern period. The more we get into the modern period, the more the deep state has come out of the woodwork. We've been starting in JFK, where we saw a tremendous deep state involvement. We need, you know, we've covered that to a certain extent. You know, you could take a whole show on the day of JFK assassination and the cover-up of those types of things. But that's when the deep state really started to show their hand. And we left off with the Carter administration.
Right.
And Jimmy Carter was actually a good Christian individual, but he was typical of soft-thinking Christians in the sense that he buys into the liberal arguments about doing good to the poor, and there's nothing wrong with giving welfare to the poor, we're just helping the poor. They don't realize that you're stealing from the productive class to redistribute to the poor, which, although you may have good benefits, you are committing theft in the name of government.
Right. I think he didn't see that, even though he had good motives, right?
That's right. That's right. So he was a useful idiot by the left, and coming into the presidency, buying into all the liberal agenda, thinking himself as a liberal, beneficent person giving U.S. aid, not realizing that there were hidden victims to that policy, people who were driven out of business because of the increased inflation and taxation to fund those types of things. But Jimmy Carter's greatest errors, of course, were the foreign policy errors, where he allowed the far left within the State Department to overthrow various governments. Most specifically, the case of Nicaragua that happened, as we talked about. Toward the end of the Jimmy Carter regime, because the establishment really wanted to bring in the Republicans again. You know, they kind of alternate Democrats to Republicans, liberal Republicans. They get the same policies through, but there was a great deal of unrest politically building up because of the mistakes of Jimmy Carter and losing Nicaragua. And then when the Iran hostage affair took place, where the Iranian Revolution, by the way, which the CIA created the Iranian Revolution by undermining the Shah, the CIA had actually funded the Ayatollah Khomeini's villa in France, where he had lived in exile for many years before returning. And so the CIA was actively involved in undermining the Shah of Iran and bringing in the radical Ayatollahs. So Iran was then under an arms embargo, so they couldn't get any parts to the U.S. weapons that they purchased, billions of dollars of F-14, top-of-the-line aircraft, and those aircraft had to be cannibalized for parts to keep the rest of them flying until there were essentially none flying. Well, the Iranian students, the radicalized left there in Iran, took over the U.S. embassy and caused all those hostages. And they were ready to actually make a deal with the United States to exchange for secret funds, which led eventually to the Iran-Contra deal. But the exchange of secret funds for getting the hostages released was finally negotiated just before the election of Ronald Reagan. And they had intended, of course, to elect George Bush, who was running for president against the candidacy of Ronald Reagan, governor of California. And so George H.W. Bush actually flew over there to help negotiate the release of the hostages in Iran. And in order to have plausible deniability that he'd never been there to the negotiations, he flew back on an SR-71. In fact, the pilot of that aircraft, Gunter Rusbacher, an American with the who eventually became a pretty good conservative expose of what was going on in government, he's the one who actually flew him back. So we have firsthand testimony.
SR-71, that's the Blackbird plane that flies up really high, right?
Yeah. And fly Mach 3, 60,000 to 80,000 feet high, and make the transatlantic journey in a couple of hours. So George Bush could get back to his office by the end of the day and no one would have believed that he could have been in Paris that day. So
just had a long lunch or something.
But part of the secret deal that they negotiated was that Iran would not release the hostages until after the election, so that it would not accrue to the favor of Jimmy Carter. It was the Iran hostage deal that made Jimmy Carter look bad as a president, that led to the resurgence of the Republicans in that election. Now, the powers that be did not intend for Ronald Reagan to win that nomination. He won in spite of their attempts to stop him. So Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump have been the only two presidents in modern history, at least since World War II, that the establishment didn't want in, that got in spite of their efforts to manipulate the elections.
All right.
Now, after Ronald Reagan won the nomination, he had a meeting, according to my uncle, W. Cleland Skousen, he had a meeting direct after with the heads of the three major networks, all controlled by the deep state, of course. And they said to him, "Mr. Reagan, as you might assume, we have the power to either make or break your presidency by how we treat you in the press." Instead of threatening him directly, after that introductory remark, they said, "We would look with favor upon your presidency if you took George H.W. Bush as your vice president." Now, here's George Bush was running against Reagan, had said many unfavorable things against Reagan. So for Reagan to accept him as his vice president was really a galling thing to do, but he did, realizing the political realities. It was a pact with the devil, which unfortunately didn't work very well.
A lot of people have wondered why he went crazy and did that, so you just explained it.
Yeah. And so that's a very interesting conspiracy fact that needs to be written into people's minds, that that's why Ronald Reagan's administration was compromised from the very beginning. Now, Ronald Reagan was a legitimate conservative. Ronald Reagan was one of the few presidents, and even as governor of California, that wrote his own speeches.
Yeah.
Now, that's nearly unheard of. And even though he had some help from speechwriters, he would rewrite liberally and put back in his conservative philosophy. He was a legitimate conservative.
That was thing that happened before even he became president, because I remember meeting him in California at a university speech, and he obviously was speaking extemporaneously at that time, and really well.
Now, Ronald Reagan did make some compromises as governor of California. He made some compromises on gun control even in his day because of the power of the left. Even in those days, he barely got elected there, and so he was used to some compromises during his administration. In fact, that's when I went back to Washington as chairman of the Conservative National Committee, because of the compromises the Reagan administration was making. And my job there in Washington was, in fact, to toughen up the conservative resistance to Ronald Reagan, which was very difficult to do because the conservatives, I mean, I had head-to-heads with Phyllis Schlafly, for example, because I was critical of Reagan and his compromises. And boy, she just lit into me. She was just so much a defender of Ronald Reagan at any cost. And I said, "But Phyllis, you know, this is not conservatism. This is a, you know," it was giving amnesty to the illegal aliens and claiming that this was going to be the end of all amnesties, and it didn't stop illegal aliens. He acceded to the biggest tax hike in history that we've ever had.
What group were you working with at that time? I missed that.
Well, it was the Conservative National Committee. This was a conglomeration of a lot of conservative groups in Washington, under the aegis of Howard Phillips of the Free Congress Foundation, or and Paul Weyrich of the Free Congress Foundation, a conservative caucus run by Howard Phillips. And I actually worked as concurrently as the executive editor of Conservative Digest under Richard Viguerie, who was the biggest of the mail order conservative gurus. He was the one who ran the mail order campaigns for all the conservative organizations. I finally left Washington when I discovered, after being there a couple of years, that most of the fundraising that they were doing for various political causes, about 90% of the money was just going to pay the salaries and wages of the people running the conservative movements there, and that very little of that was actually being used to fund the causes. It wasn't because they weren't sincere. It's just that life and doing things in Washington, D.C. is very expensive, and they did take, you know, these leaders some pretty high salaries, which I objected to. But in any case, during my time in Washington, when I began for the first time my World Affairs Brief, it was a printed newsletter at that time. I developed a lot of contacts in Washington. And so much of my ability to decipher what is true and what isn't true on the internet today is based upon my experience of what you can really know in Washington and what you can't. So there's a lot of people like QAnon that have been claiming as an insider that the military is going to have a coup over the deep state and then Trump is going to overcome them. And I knew that that wasn't possible. I knew even in those days that NSA spying was happening on everything and that the military hierarchy was compromised, that they'd all been screened according to globalist philosophy at the national war colleges. Right. And only globalist yes men were allowed to rise to the ranks of generals or admirals. And
yeah, Q's obviously said a lot of things that are clearly not true, right on the face. And yeah. Do you think that it's a group made up of these yes men military leaders, or who is it?
No, it's just it's a deep state disinformation. It may not be an actual, it probably isn't an actual person, but you know, and all the signs of disinformation, everything is cryptic. Name me one of the conservatives that speaks in cryptic, ununderstandable notes. Nobody does that in conservative. It's just, we believe in truth and being transparent and saying, telling it like it is. And
right.
Q never says anything straight. So it has, but you know, certain people are taken in by that as if he's having to preserve himself. You can't tell me that the NSA can't tell where a post from any of these email things are coming from. They know exactly where they're going. They can track
probably know where it was if it was face-to-face. I mean, they're not confused.
Yeah. So, in any case, Ronald Reagan starts his to try to do the right thing. And he keeps getting... Now, one of the things that part of that agreement with Ronald Reagan, with the heads, was that George W. Bush was to be the vice president, and he was also to have control over personnel in the White House. Now,
that was pretty much the end of the whole thing, I guess.
Yeah. So George W. Bush staffed the entire Reagan House, White House, with liberals, some of them Republicans, a lot of them Democrats, and a whole host of homosexuals. There's a whole gay clique in the Reagan White House. And we found out about that at Williamsburg, a big celebration of the in 1976 on the Constitution, which Reagan did... have a legitimate celebration of the Constitution, and he put a good friend of mine in charge of the that program, and he had to fight against Warren Burger, you know, the Supreme Court, who wanted to corrupt that and water down the pro-founding father issue of the Constitution. But at Williamsburg, they ended up having some orgy of gay orgy of administration officials that was happening during the big celebration in Williamsburg.
And now, why do you think that was important to Bush to put those guys in, too?
Well, you've got to remember that Bush is deep state, much higher than his son ever was. His son was just a puppet, George W. Bush. Right. George H.W. Bush, you don't get to be head of CIA unless you're really deep state. Even though someone like William Colby got killed, he was head of the CIA, but he got killed because he saw too much and... objected to it, and so
conscience.
He was killed in a canoeing accident where his body turned up dead, and anyway, very strange circumstances. But in any case, Ronald Reagan tried to do his best, but he was bucked at every point by his administration, and he could successfully overrule them, and that's why eventually they threw that assassination attempt at him. John Hinckley Jr. was the son of a friend of John Hinckley Sr., who was a friend of George W. Bush. John Hinckley Jr. had disappeared from the radar for two solid years, and the first thing he did when he came back and saw his family, he had an appointment with a psychiatrist to establish his mental instability. In other words, I think he was groomed as a mind control victim for a couple of years, And he had to establish his bona fides as mentally unstable so that when he would do the assassination attempt, that he could then get off, which he did, on, you know, being insane.
With no connections to anybody, of course.
Yeah, of course, the media would not cover the connections of his father with the Bush family.
Right.
But there was also at least one .38 bullet that was shot. Reagan was hit with a .22 bullet, which is what he was firing, but there were other shooters as well. We're lucky that Reagan was left alive. Brady took a hit as well. But just like in the RFK assassination at the hotel in Los Angeles, there were 9 bullets taken out of the cabinetry in that hotel kitchen when Sirhan's gun only held 6.
Right.
And those bullets were not, you know, the same caliber as Sirhan's.
People have talked about, the kind of bullets they use that are made out of ice and they melt. And people have been talking about that for the Reagan assassination as well.
I can't speak to that. That's very difficult to do in ice, to keep it frozen for that. You know, that adds a level of complexity. I don't have any confirmation of any factual thing. I don't think you have to go that far. But in any case, you had a very similar assassination happen to Yitzhak Rabin of Israel. He's a prime minister who started out as a globalist, got cold feet, decided he wasn't going to sell out Israel to the Palestinians, and he got assassinated, and he actually survived the assassination and was shot in the back seat of his car by his own bodyguard. And that book was, if anyone wants to read it, is by Barry Chamish, called The Assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. And it's a very, very good documented book on how they covered that up from the hospital. It reads like the JFK assassination, how they covered up the frontal wounds of JFK by taking him first by helicopter to Walter Reed Hospital. And then he went to Bethesda Naval Hospital, where he turned up in a Navy body bag, and when they opened it up, the top of the head fell off and the brain was gone, and the surgeon says, this guy's already had an autopsy. Dutifully recorded by 2 FBI agents were there, and the FBI agents' memos were buried by J. Edgar Hoover, so that they never were made public until years later, when David Lifton's book came out, Best Evidence, which is the history of the alteration of the body of JFK to eliminate the frontal shots. But anyway, that's how the deep state works. They control doctors, they control coroners, they control media, they control military and helicopter pilots, and they have the ability to use national security to silence everyone who wants to blow the whistle about things. Mm-hmm. So Ronald Reagan tried to do his best. He was assassinated, and he was a different man after that.
Yeah.
He was much more cautious. His wife started to go to Gene Dixon to get spiritualistic help and protection for the president, knowing that the deep state was out to get him. It's interesting that during the Ronald Reagan presidency, they made him a hero by saying that, he was responsible for bringing down the Soviet Union.
Right.
And this was very interesting because it wasn't true. Even though the U.S. was, in fact, being outgunned the U.S. was outproducing militarily the Soviet Union, and they were getting further and further behind. The claim of an economic collapse of the Soviet Union, or that they were brought to bankruptcy. I mean, they'd been going on for 20, 30 years with a mandatory system of using their gold and inflation itself to create rubles to pay their people. And it had gotten to a subsistence level of people that were in long bread lines in the Soviet Union. They'd line up for an hour or two each day to get their bread. And we're living on a fairly subsistence diet, but the military-industrial complex was churning very, very rapidly. But in fact, Ronald Reagan, when he said, went to Berlin and, Mr. Gorbachev,
tear down this wall,
he was sincere. I mean, Reagan was sincere, but the globalists saw this as an opportunity when Russia, and they didn't direct Russia to fake their own demise. I mean, the Russians already had long planned this. Anatoly Golitsyn wrote a book, New Lies for Old, where he predicted, he talked about Lenin having predicted or having faked the demise of the Soviet Union, or at least economic reform in order to get Western aid, which he was successful at. And he said, I know that the Soviets are going to do the same thing and pretend that they're collapsing to get Western aid. And this is a good time to cover the phony fall of the Soviet Union, because it really was. Now, I, as a journalist, I saw what was happening, and immediately alarm bells started to go off when I heard the news reports about the fall of the Soviet Union, especially the report about the KGB having failed to kidnap Mikhail Gorbachev in his undefended villa. He had two or three bodyguards. And since when has the KGB failed to kidnap some individual because of two or three bodyguards? I mean, the KGB was tremendously able at that time. And the whole notion that he failed. And then the news report said that the heads of the Defense Department, the KGB, and the GRU, the government military intelligence agency, had all fled for their lives. And I immediately thought, wait a minute, who are they fleeing from?
Exactly, yeah.
You say, who are they fleeing from if these are the heads of all the most powerful police and military agencies in the government? And I said, this doesn't make sense. But I was the only one to raise the question. Nobody in the media even batted an eye. They were all accepting this story, and especially repeating the talking points of the Soviet Union, talking about we've got to honor our constitution and allow the democracy of the people to speak. And well, since when have the Soviets honored, you know, democracy or the constitution? They've had a one-party state for years. And so when I, as the news started to filter out, I was in New York at the time that it was happened on a consultation, and I happened to be at the airport with some Hungarians. And I said, what did you think about the overthrow of Ceausescu and the replacement by his second in command? He said, oh, he's no anti-communist. We've known him for years. And he, and of course, Ceausescu was the one who refused to step down and was killed by the Russians in order to stop, in order to go forth. We found out later, for example, in the memoirs of Erich Honecker, the East German dictator, that he had given, been given orders from Moscow to let the riots of the students in Leipzig go forward. Because, you know, at East German universities, the Stasi were everywhere. You couldn't start an anti-communist movement or you'd be hauled off to jail within an hour.
Right.
And in fact, I saw a documentary on the fall of the Soviet Union by a Russian who was talking about the euphoria of being able to, you know, go into Red Square and protest against the Union to support Yeltsin. And he said, you know, but the thing that really bothered all of us is we kept asking ourselves, where were the KGB?
Yeah,
I mean, the KGB should have been all over us, and they were nowhere to be found. And he said, the television station, which is still controlled by the Communist Party, didn't shut off the power to the cameras when they were filming Yeltsin. They let him make his speech on top of the tank and thing. It was all theater. It was all theater. So it isn't to say that there wasn't an inner yearning for the Eastern European to belong. Certainly there was a yearning. But the stand down of the Soviet guards at the border, the stand down of the KGB, the stand down of the Stasi, all that was on orders of Moscow. This was a scripted fall of the Soviet Union, and the Communist Party just went underground. And in fact, for years after that, I would get reports, and there was a few blogs that coming out of Russia, and they were saying, you know, when we go into the Kremlin, we talk, you know, people keep saying the party says this, the party says that. Well, wait a minute. It's not supposed to be a communist party. It's supposed to be overthrown. But it was clearly still running things. One of the evidences of that is that the new follow-on Soviet Union was the Commonwealth of Independent States. And guess who was the Secretary General of the Commonwealth? Boris Berezovsky, who became the one of the big wealthy oligarchs.
Right.
When I started to look at the wealthy oligarchs, whether it was Guzinski or Berezovsky or Khodorkovsky, one thing became very apparent. was the major question is, where did they get the money to buy up all of these industries from the former Soviet Union?
Right.
Nobody was supposed to have billions of rubles in order to do that. Well, they apparently got these loans from the state bank, the Soviet state bank. They were loaned the money to buy it. Well, it only figured out to me that Berezovsky was, in fact, the new head of the Commonwealth because he was, in fact, the Communist Party leader underground, or at least behind the scenes, that was calling the shots to the Politburo. One of the warning signs that any good Russian archivist should have, or a scholar should have come up with, was the fact that Gorbachev was a mid-level bureaucrat 2 years before he ascended to the premiership. Each of the heads of the KGB, the defense minister, and the GRU were mid-level bureaucrats before they had suddenly been elevated to those high positions, of which they fled during the coup. In other words, these were puppets put into place, and if your puppets, I mean, if you've been put in, look, how does the Soviet Union usually get a dictatorship? Well, you have Khrushchev rising through the ranks and killing people in order to get to be the premier. You have Lenin killing people like Trotsky in order to consolidate power. That's how Stalin got to be at the head. It's a conspiracy of murder by power in order to gain power. And so when you have people naming Gorbachev to be the premier, supposedly he didn't get there by climbing over other people. He got there because somebody more powerful named him to the position. The same with these other people who had to resign. They weren't the real heads.
Were you talking about the central bank in Russia funding oligarchs and getting them the money to suddenly be rich enough to buy up all the industries? How much, and this is probably enough material for a whole other show or two, but how much of the power do you see coming from the maybe high above visible level rulers of the central bank, and how much of people that were ordering them what to do?
Well, what I'm saying, my conclusion is because Gorbachev rose to be the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Independent States, he had to be the ruling Communist Party leader behind the scenes. He was the one who telling the state bank, you loan me the money. And the only reason they listened to Gorbachev is because they knew he was their boss. Now, how do I know that? One of the blogs said he was in the Kremlin and he saw a meeting whereby Yeltsin and all the ministers were meeting with Berezovsky, and Yeltsin steps aside and lets Berezovsky go in the door first.
Oh, okay.
Now you see, that is an indication in Russian hierarchy that Berezovsky was higher than Yeltsin. That has led to my conclusion that Berezovsky was the hidden Soviet leader running the shot that pulled off this whole coup. And he was the one who named Gorbachev. He was the one who named Yeltsin. And that's why Yeltsin deferred to him. As further proof of that, when I mentioned before that Spanish intelligence confirmed that Gorbachev had met with Putin five times before Putin ascended to the president, that means Gorbachev was running the show. Even when he was at his villa in Spain, he was still running the show.
So Gorbachev had both visible and invisible roles, playing two different levels of power at the same time, right? And that's kind of confirmed by his behavior publicly, which was really supporting globalism and supporting using the climate hoax to further globalism. That was really clear as one element of the whole plan.
Gorbachev was purely a puppet of the Russian globalist. And remember, it's not that the Russian globalists are part of the globalist conspiracy of the Anglo-American globalists. The Russians intend to run their own version of the New World Order. They're learning from the Anglo-American globalists. They're learning from that climate change has the means of controlling property and has the means of controlling energy. And it's a major taxing scheme.
Right.
Because, you know, nobody reduces carbon pollution, which isn't a pollutant, by the way.
Right.
They simply pay for it and they keep polluting. As if it were a pollution, yeah.
It's also a way to launder the accumulation of huge amounts of money in the new carbon credit exchange.
That's exactly right. So, just to finish my story on Russia, where we go for it, there has been a change. However, Putin was put in by the oligarchs, but eventually he purged the oligarchs and replaced them with his own. He banished Gorbachev, who then took up residency in London, England, and eventually had Gorbachev killed. And he banished Grzynski. Khodorkovsky, a big oil monarch, went to jail and for prison. And then a whole new bunch of oligarchs came in under Putin, and Putin, according to my sources in Russia, is getting a cut of about 4% of all of their international illicit drug trade and government money. Or they get a cut. You see, these oligarchs control all the trade coming from Europe. All the tariffs and things are paid to them, and they give Putin a cut. That's why that palace in Sochi was, in fact, built by Putin with his money. He doesn't claim that it's his. It belonged to the Russian government, but everybody says it's Putin's. He's probably the wealthiest man in the world because of this relationship of the cuts that he takes from the oligarchs, which he controls under him now. So now we have returned to the old Stalinesque system of Russia, where Putin really is the leader, not the oligarchs. The oligarchs are under him, whereas Putin started out being under Berezovsky and Grzynski, and he overthrew them.
So Putin's done some incredible achievements, according to what you described, right? I mean, most people have been brought up through different scenarios, and he's actually overcome situations stacked against him in the beginning, if I understand you right.
Well, I'm not going to address it in those positive words that you said, overcome.
I'm not saying to do good things. I'm just saying amazing ability to get where he is.
Well, it's just a ruthless ability. I don't view that as, it doesn't take amazing to be ruthless. Stalin was ruthless,
right?
Otherwise fairly stupid, but he was ruthless, and ruthlessness could overcome a lot of stupidity.
So you're saying Putin's using the same qualities of incredible ruthlessness and has gotten where he was because of it.
I mean, you had to be pretty smart to be able to overthrow, Berezovsky as the head oligarch. But he was able to do that through consolidating power underneath himself. Now, mark my words, the Soviet Union is not a democracy. They have elections, but all of the smaller parties, and even the Communist Party, takes a role as one of the lesser parties now. But so there's the public Communist Party, and then there's the real Communist Party that runs all the other parties, like the United Party that Putin belongs to. It's another extension of the Communist Party. So it is rigged. It's only the very smallest of parties, libertarian and otherwise, that don't have any political power that aren't controlled by the Communists. All the major competing parties are controlled by the Communist Party.
Right.
Now, what was the result of the faking the fall of the Soviet Union? Well, the West came in, first of all, and let Harvard University come and instruct the Russians on how to set up free markets. Now, does that look to you like an oxymoron?
That sounds important. Say that once more. I'm sorry. I want to
Harvard
really
University was hired at multi-million dollars by the U.S. State Department to come into Russia and to show the Russians how to set up free markets.
Wow.
Now, the Harvard University knows nothing about free markets. They know a great deal about controlled markets.
Yeah, but it sounds good if you call them free, right?
That's right. And at the same time, the U.S. began to send suitcases loads of $100 bills over to Russia to give to the oligarchs. And that's why when the oligarchs would go to Europe, they only had $100 bills to pay for things. They didn't have any change. They would give $100 bills for tips, because they didn't have anything but $100 bills, courtesy of the United States government.
Wow.
The U.S. did the same thing in the war in Iraq, sending palletfuls of $100 bills to pay off all of the competing factions to win the war in Iraq. That's how we won the war, by paying off the other factions. And so the U.S. has spread tremendous amount of inflations that have never show up as M3 in the supply of money. That's reported by the Federal Reserve.
Is that the reason that all the Iraqi troops ran away during the shock and awe campaign?
Well, that's a different story. We'll get to that when we cover the phony war on terror. But the United States sent in all of your major oil companies, ExxonMobil and Texaco and others, to rebuild the entire oil infrastructure of Russia, making Russia one of the major exporters of oil, and we are responsible for giving Russia essentially all of that money and technologies, and we've taught them how to do fracking in order to increase their things. We've gone in and set up plants and factories and other things, just like in World War II. We built the Ford truck plants and the aviation plants, gave them all that technology. That's all part of building the best enemy that money can buy, is what they've been doing over the years.
I mean, I hate to see your premise be right, but it really sounds logical and kind of inescapable. I just, you know, it is the kind of thing that our deep state and its partners would be working on, you know, ultimate total destruction and concentration of power at one point. So,
but you've got to remember that it's not going to be ever concentration of power in any single point, because Satan is ultimately running this conspiracy, and he has three competing powers of centers of power. There's the Anglo-American globalists, which we deal with, but there's the Russians are another center, and he's promised them victory, and he's also talking, I believe, to the Chinese communists and promising them victory.
But each one thinks they're going to be the only one left.
That's right. Each one thinks they're going to be there, but Satan always keeps competing evil so that he can justify conflict and so that it's not easy. Remember, the true tyranny, and I think he's going to let the Anglo-American globalists win out ultimately, but in order to legitimize their tyranny, there has to be an enemy, so they can justify tyrannical militarization of everything. And that's why after World War III, I think Russia will be taken down, because the American globalists will cut a deal with China to attack Russia's rear in exchange for aid and trade and everything. And so after the war, when Russia's defeated, and Satan was running Hitler as well, and that's why you see Hitler was sacrificed, and then Russia was the new Cold War enemy. And I think the same thing's going to play out in World War III. Russia will be sacrificed, and China will be the new Cold War enemy, and therefore justify the Anglo-American globalists keeping this new militarized global government as an intact thing and not letting sovereignty come back to America. It'll be too dangerous. China's there threatening war. We can't go back to individual nationhood.
And they couldn't do that whole scam if there was one centralized government.
That's right. Everyone would view it as, well, why can't we be free again? Oh, because there's no threat anymore, we'd say. We can be free. Let us go back to being sovereign. And they won't allow that to happen. That's why they always want, Satan always wants an opposition enemy to justify tyranny. And that's what's happening. So all of this happened at the end of the Reagan administration. And of course, after that, you had George H.W. Bush elected as president. He was a one-term president. The deep state used Ross Perot to overthrow George W. Bush and bring Bill Clinton into the presidency. They did that by, and we know that now because the Perot organization was almost in daily contact with the Democratic Party during that campaign. And so he was really running as a in-between, not non-Democrat, on behalf of the Democrats in order to overthrow the Republicans. Maybe not knowingly, but at least the organization, there were people within his organization that were part of the deep state that were managing this in order to overthrow George W. Bush.
And he was. They let him be sincere. It was more believable anyway.
Yes, it is more believable. And so when Bill Clinton came in, of course, we had... one of the things as a political scientist I noted when I was watching the news at that time is that they started to say at the beginning, a year before the election, the Democratic front runners are, and they started a list with Bill Clinton, governor of Arkansas. And I'd never heard of Bill Clinton, governor of Arkansas. I thought, wait a minute. They're obviously putting out somebody who they've got someone in mind for, because, you know, he's never been a senator. He's never been anything significant. What's Arkansas in terms of a state? It's not one of the big states like California, New York, etc. But I knew they were pushing Bill Clinton at that time, and they pushed him all the way to the presidency. Now, when we go back and study the Iran-Contra deal, you find out that Bill Clinton was deeply involved in all the drug smuggling that was coming into the United States because he had established a smuggling base in Mena, Arkansas. Right. And this was a base of operations where the drugs were being smuggled out of Mexico and Central America, and arms were going out of MENA in the arms trade for condoms. This was during the Reagan administration. And you had Caspar Weinberger, who was a deep state operative in the Attorney General's office running this operation. You had Bill Barr during the H.W. Bush administration as his Attorney General. And he was sabotaging all the investigations about CIA and DEA drug running. Terry Reid came out with his book at that time called Compromised. He was actually flying out of Mena, Arkansas, and he documented a lot of the drug running. He was eventually then taken out of his pilot role and sent into Mexico from the CIA. And one of his first jobs there was to take a cargo shipping container full of cocaine and ship it through American Customs, have it certified on the American border as drug-free so that it wouldn't be inspected. And he opened it up and found it was full of cocaine, called the CIA, you know, people and told him what he found. And they said, shut that thing up and send it on its way and don't ever tell anybody about it. And he refused, he quit, he wrote the book Compromised. He was terrorized his entire day. They tried to destroy him financially. If you want to learn about the deep state, you read the book Compromised. It tells an awful lot about CIA and its drug running operations.
Who does it list as the author?
Terry Reid.
Okay.
It's still available on Amazon. But you see, the drug running of the CIA goes clear back to the Vietnam War. When Khun San, the general in Thailand, or he had this whole heroin growing region in Thailand, and he was shipping drugs through the American military. They would put it in soldiers' body bags and ship them back to the United States. That's how crude the methods were during the Vietnam War. They got to be much more sophisticated. Terry Reid talks about having special transponder codes on your airplanes so that you could get through the international air boundary where you had to, you know, you could get through without talking to ATC or air traffic control if you had these special codes on your aircraft. Everything for drug running. It was official as can be. So Oliver North, who still to this day pretends to be a conservative, and he may well be a conservative, but he was deeply involved in this drug trade. He was deeply involved in the Iran-Contra and all the illegalities, and I'm sure he rationalized as being his patriotic duty because he was working under Republican administration, so it had to be right.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't trust Terry or Oliver North because of that relationship there. And so during the Clinton administration, of course, the drug trafficking through the CIA increased tremendously. He was a very blackmailable president, guilty of rape multiple times of women and had multiple relationships, not just in the White House. When he was finally impeached, by the way, it was the Republican hierarchy that sabotaged the impeachment. Mr. Skippers, Shippers, they call him, Dutch name Skippers, was the Democratic. He was a Democratic prosecutor of Clinton, and he, in his book, said that it was the Republican hierarchy that sabotaged his case and let Clinton off the hook. The Democrats couldn't get caught doing it because the Republicans were in the majority at that time. So it was the Republican hierarchy that saved Clinton from impeachment and voted for acquittal on that. But there was a much bigger thing going on during that they covered up as well in the impeachment, and that was Clinton's giving military technology to China during his administration through the Commerce Department. It was rampant. So Clinton was a terrible president in many regards. He's the one who signed PDD 60 in 1997, revamping our military nuclear doctrine,
right,
ordering our military to be prepared to absorb a nuclear first strike and retaliate afterwards. Now, if any of your listeners doubt my word, they can actually read the summary of PDD 60, which is still secret. And I don't think President Trump even knows about it.
Yeah.
Because Craig Cernillo, who was an arms control person, I think who helped write it, that's how he knew about it. The Washington Post came out and said, no, PDD 60 does not, in fact, stop the nuclear or the military from launching on warning. And he came out with an op-ed and said, yes, it does. And the summary of his remarks are in the November of 1997 archives of armscontroltoday.org. Armscontroltoday.org. Go to archives, hit November 1997. You can still read his summary. And he says, newspapers have said that it does not stop launch on warning, but it does. It instructs our military they are not to launch on warning, but prepare to retaliate after a nuclear strike. And General Butch Neal of the Marine Corps said, retaliate with what?
Yeah, exactly. Harsh language, probably. Except that'll be censored anyway, so they can't do that, too. But is that armscontrolarchive.org, you said?
Armscontroltoday.org.
Today, okay.
The archives go to November 1997.
Today, okay.
And you can read it for yourself. Now, in 1997, President Clinton also unilaterally declared, as a sign of goodwill toward the Soviet Union, that we have no ill intent, that we're going to keep 50% of our submarines in port at any one time, just to make sure that we can more easily be targeted.
Right. Good plan. Do you think that Clinton was doing all this stuff on his own volition, or whose orders was he following?
He wouldn't know anything about military tactics or things. This was all
right.
Dictated him by globalists who were controlling the military.
Okay.
Now, I think PDD-60 is simply gone by the wayside. Nobody talks about it. I've asked several people in the military. They've never heard about it, so no one's obviously talking about it. But I'll tell you, it has to be still in force because it is big news when you revamp the military doctrine. It was big news in 1997 when they revamped the entire military doctrine of the U.S. And I'll tell you, if you took away PDD-60, the arms control people would be screaming bloody murder, and it would be big news again if you were allowed to launch on warning.
When you said it was big news that they instituted this under Clinton, I don't remember hearing about it in the public media. Where was it big news?
Well, it was. There were two articles in the Washington Post and New York Times trying to assuage people about it and talking about it not prohibiting the U.S. from launching on warning. And that's what induced Craig Cernillo to say, oh, yes, it does.
Okay.
I mean, I won't say it was front page news, but it was news. Whenever you get in the Washington Post and you have a counter to those articles by an arms controller, it's news in Washington, D.C. Now, it never hit the papers in any other city. But it was big papers, big news, at least in the military circles in Washington, D.C. and New York.
And they felt they had to talk about it. Why? Because wouldn't it be better if nobody ever heard about it?
It would be better if nobody heard about it. But it was such a big change. Remember, this happened just after the Reagan administration. And, you know, Clinton was in. There's still a lot of Republicans that were concerned. And so to a certain extent, the military had to justify this to the Republicans in the Armed Service Committee who were, anyway, the New York Times ended up assuaging the public by lying and saying it doesn't do what it really does.
Right.
And that's the only reason we come out of it, is they tried to lie and say it doesn't do what you're concerned about.
Okay. And he also agreed to keep 50% of the submarines in port, you said, right?
The nuclear ballistic missile submarines in port. And to this day, there's still over 50% are in port at any one time. There's only two ports, Kings Bay, Georgia, and Bangor, Washington, which is in the Seattle, Puget Sound area. And that means those two cities are toast. They're going to be hit by a massive nuclear strike. And that means there's only at most 4 to 5, maybe 6 submarines out there. And none of the Trident 5 missile submarine warheads have the capability of penetrating hardened targets. They're not that big of a warhead.
So the reason that it's okay to keep them in port is there's this code of honor that no enemies, they promise to never attack those ports, right?
That's right. No, it's not that they promise. It's to make sure that the Russians realize that we have no ill intent. We're going to make ourselves vulnerable to prove we have no ill intent.
To show our honor, basically.
That's right. And it's literally suicidal, but not suicidal. As I pointed out in my World Affairs brief, the globalists wouldn't do this if they didn't have secret weapons established where they could still win the war after absorbing a nuclear first strike.
Yeah, they don't need the archaic submarines, basically. Right?
Well, it's not that they don't need them. I think that they have. They're willing to sacrifice them because they have, I believe, I think Brilliant Pebbles and other space-based systems of interceptor missiles did get built. And the proof of that is that General Mattis, after he was released as defense secretary, spoke before one of the major investment conferences. It was a private conference. And he said to them, you would be surprised at how much money we're spending that isn't on the budget in space. You would be surprised how much money off the budget that we're spending in space.
Wow.
And so I think that these space-based weapons are being built specifically so that we'll absorb a nuclear first strike. Our military leaders come out of their bunkers and say, we didn't know this was happening. The Russians deceived us. But now that our military has been decapitated, we've got to join in a militarized global government in order to prosecute this war. And to protect us against any further nuclear strikes, while they're regrouping under, they've got to have space-based interceptors that can stop any Russian and Chinese missiles from taking down American cities. So I don't think American cities are going to get hit per se, except those very closely integrated with military bases. And that's why I do think that people need to prepare for nuclear war, at least for fallout. And if you're close enough to a military base where you're at risk of blast, you need to move.
Well, there's these details that people talk about, like nuclear winter and stuff like that.
It's propaganda. There won't be a nuclear winter.
It's not going to be that bad.
That's right.
And those more advanced weapons would be owned, I would guess, by a supranational agency of some kind that's there to protect countries that have lost their military, like the U.S., for example.
Well, I think those defense weapons are owned by the United States. I don't think they turn those over to the globalists. I mean, unless they can completely control the globalists. But, it's interesting, the globalists are not as democratic as they think. They still maintain control of the money. And if they're going to be a new currency someday, but it's not going to be the collapse of the dollar prior to war. It's going to be after war, when a global government, there'll be a new global currency. But you can bet the same people controlling the Federal Reserve are going to be controlling that currency, too. They're not going to give up that power.
Right. They're not going to all retire at the same time.
Right.
So, well, that's a lot to absorb. It's lucky we're only recording this once a week, because it's going to take me all week to just think through and digest everything that we've just gone over. That's a lot. And if we're thinking about how to break this up into a next episode, what do you see calling the next one, or what do you think about that?
Well, the next one is going to take us into one of the most important, and that's the creation of the phony war on terror through George W. Bush administration in 9/11.
Okay.
And that ushered in an entire new history of intervention around the world based upon creating terror and then defending against terror.
All right. It's like another cliffhanger suspense ending, you know, with people just on the edge of their chairs waiting for the next piece. So, including me. So thanks for being with us. And hold on, we'll say goodbye in the break here.
All right.
Okay, so there goes Joel Skousen. That was a lot of information in a short time. Wow. I mean, I really understand why one of our recommended news broadcasters that we, of course, can't name anymore, or else we're banned forever, as always said, his head is spinning. And even though it's not spinning, I mean, I understand how he feels. I feel that way, kind of. I'm trying to absorb everything that he shared with us. Incredible opportunity to learn from somebody who's actually teaching from his own insight and experience instead of a checklist of things to repeat that he memorized. I mean, I really like education a lot. I feel like it's critically important for all of us, especially in areas that are relevant to our life. And this is building to a point when we finish the other parts of the series that my hope and plan is that we'll get into him talking about the way to bring communities together, places to go that are good for this kind of thing. Of course, he's put a lot of that already into his really excellent book, Strategic Relocation, which I read quite a while ago. I have to reread it because there's a lot of it I don't clearly remember, and probably have a new outlook on them after so many years of work since then. So anyway, I really appreciate getting to sit in the front row of the class with with all of you and listening to Joel. I hope you got a lot out of it. We'll have another episode very shortly. And, you know, as I always get reminded by the nature of the material that we cover, go to lostartsradio.com, get yourself on the mailing list, which we're not using much right now, but if we get unable to use the major platforms, that may be a way that we can stay in touch with you and send you good material and maybe embedded selected videos and things like that that you wouldn't get otherwise. And that's at lostartsradio.com. And then even with what we did talk about, there's a lot that we can't get into publicly. And we try to do that in our private, more secure platform, which is Planetary Healing Club. And that meets every week live, interactive. We cover anything that you guys want to get into, with particularly taking advantage of the research that I've been able to do over the last five plus decades into the suppressed health information that would be good for you to have and use at your discretion. Consciousness issues that go with that, how to change lifestyle habits so that you take care of yourself better without running into addictions that make it impossible. How to do those positive changes without the need for willpower, which is a really big issue if you understand what I'm talking about here. You can get an access point into those private meetings at planetaryhealingclub.com. There are small dues charged for membership in that ongoing live meeting, which all go to our nonprofit that we hope one way or another is going to get enough money to actually build a physical school that will demonstrate a lot of the things that we're just able to talk about right now. And I really want to do that. I'd like to live and work there for the rest of this lifetime if I can. And the only way we do that is get lots of money, and we're not selling products. So it's quite challenging. The only thing that's giving money to the nonprofit that will build and run the school is the memberships in Planetary Healing Club. So you might want to do that, because you get two advantages. One, you help us get closer into building the physical school. The other is you get direct access into being able to talk about some of this implementation of this stuff in a private, supportive atmosphere with other people working on the same stuff, how to fix your own health and general life quality, transform that to start operating on top efficiency to deal with what all these things that are coming to us in the near future, if Joel's correct. And I think there's a lot in what he's saying that's valid. So that's at planetaryhealingclub.com. It's not expensive and it helps us out. I don't want to really push products as a way to get the money we need, because I don't want to sell something because we need the money and have that temptation to tell you, oh yeah, this is a really great product, because we really need the money from it. You know, I'm not against that, but I want to be careful of it. So we're not really doing it so far. So we get money to the nonprofit from the club donations. And I'm trying to make some of my private personal time available for anybody that is in really demanding life and health situations that wants to have personalized attention to that. If you're interested in that, one-on-one Skype consulting, which technically is free for people who make a certain donation to the club, or not to the club, to the nonprofit, I'll give you the details of that if you want it at richard@lostartsradio.com. We can give you some answers about how that works there. And I'm not a medical doctor, and even if I was, it probably, you know, wouldn't be for long with the information that I'm sharing with people on that. It's based on really ancient approaches to health and to deeper consciousness that opens up your forgotten abilities that used to be normal, adapting that ancient approach to modern circumstances. And it's been a long, long project to do that, and it's still ongoing. I'm working on it every day right now for myself and for you both. So if you're interested in that one-on-one private help, write to me, richard@lostartsradio.com. We've also started a new page that Doug has set up now called subscribestar.com/lostartsradio. That would really help us stay on the air if you want to make even a small donation, or if you've got, and it's set up so that it can be one time or recurring. Recurring is more useful, but certainly whatever you feel is appropriate. And if you have large resources and you understand what we're trying to do, which I can't fully, you know, get onto on the limited shows, but you get a feeling for that and you know that it's valuable and you have resources, talk to me about it, because we need to find some way of funding this as soon as we possibly can. And we need your personal help if you believe in what we're doing. The other thing, as far as disappearing off major channels, we have a channel that's dedicated on Brighteon.com. Mike's really great non-censoring platform that's just starting to become known now. Brighteon.com is brighteon.com/channel/lostartsradio. And you can start your own channel there. You can watch videos there. Either one of those activities helps get them better known, and they really need that. So it's something, a great project worth supporting just by using the service, brighteon.com. I think that's about it. Subscribestar.com, too, for us is barely known so far. So if you believe in it, you might want to tell other people. Eventually, we'll reach people with good resources that have good intent, too, to try to mitigate the things that Joel foresees coming in the future. I'm not saying those things have to happen. I think Joel would probably agree that you prepare for them, and then any opportunities you get to make the future better, you take advantage of that as well. So that's what we're trying to do with the Lost Arts Project. And communicate with us if you want, richard@lostartsradio.com. Take a look at a little more insight into the bigger project at our nonprofit site, which is lostartsresearchinstitute.org. And the tab there that's called Eldamar tells a little bit about one possible configuration of the physical school. And until we get the money from somewhere to build that, we'll do what we can online. Really appreciate your being there with us and participating in the whole thing. Hope to see you in the club meeting sometime. Look into that, planetaryhealingclub.com. Otherwise, we'll make as many of the free videos as we can. And hope you have a great rest of the weekend, and we'll see you at the next presentation here. Talk to you soon.
Introducing Lost Arts Radio on Subscribestar.com. Just go to Subscribestar.com/LostArtsRadio to find our rewards program, offering 10 different giving levels starting at just $5 a month. We offer incredible value for any rewards level, from extra monthly interview videos not available publicly to subscription-based Planetary Healing Club videos once, twice, or three times a month, to private counseling sessions with Lost Arts Radio host Richard Sachs, to tech help with me, Doug Diamond. We even have one option where you can be the star on Lost Arts Radio as our guest on a specially produced show just for you. We conduct an interview with you and broadcast it to our growing network and listenership. Our subscribe star levels are one of a kind and offer great rewards for any budget. Please help support Lost Arts Radio. We can't do it without you. With increasing censorship on many of our channels, we really need your support today to keep doing what we're doing. As Richard says, we're not even at survival level yet. Lost Arts Radio has 3 weekly shows. Lost Arts Radio Live each Saturday night at 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific, which is a live stream currently on multiple platforms in case we get banned from some of the larger ones. Right now, we're on 2 YouTube channels, Facebook Live, Periscope, which is Twitter, Twitch, and DLive. You can access these broadcasts by going to www.lostartsradio.com/live for all the links to those channels. The Planetary Healing Club meets right after Lost Arts Radio Live at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Saturday nights. And our Sunday show with guests airs at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Sunday nights on our Blog Talk Radio channel, our YouTube channels, Facebook pages, and on Brighteon. Be sure to sign up for our free email list just in case we do get banned on big tech's platforms. It's just a matter of time, really. They don't like the stuff we talk about, and they do not want the truth out there. In fact, they have already attacked us numerous times. Join our free email list so we can let you know where we are and how to access our shows. The sign-up button is right on the top right on most pages of our website. The best starting point for all things Lost Arts Radio is our main site, lostartsradio.com, where you can find the hottest new selection videos that we curate just for you. Those are on the homepage and added to daily, as well as articles and breaking news about information you really need to know. Our show archives, the 10 most recent shows, are right on our homepage, as well as our Blog Talk Radio page at blogtalkradio.com/lostartsradio, or just click the All Things Radio Show tab right on our website. We're in the podcast directory on iTunes, and all of our shows except the banned ones are on our YouTube channels at Lost Arts Radio and at Diamond Disc. Our Brighteon page is really taking off, and we often have editor's picks videos right on their homepage. Visit brighteon.com/channel/lostartsradio. On our site, you can also access our free listener forum as well as sign up for the Planetary Healing Club, which is just $25 a month, where you get private access to a one-on-one interaction with host Richard Sachs and myself and the other club members who participate live. More info can be found at planetaryhealingclub.com. We're providing solutions in there to make the world a better place. Come join us. Stay tuned, because up next, you'll get to hear a really great song by an independent artist that we're doing our best to support. Go to lostartsradio.com/music for the full list of all the great songs and bands that we spin on our audio-only podcast shows. If you're in a band and want to submit a song for consideration for airplay on Lost Arts Radio, visit my website at diamonddiscaudio.com for more information about the music placement, mastering, and mixing work that I do. Thanks again for listening to and supporting Lost Arts Radio. We love having you as part of our family to learn, experience, and grow with.
Free falling on, now where do I begin? Free falling till the birds forget to sing. But I found you in a crowd of anguish, standing on a solid ground. So true, like you're holding.
Singing, I love.
I'm gonna hang around for you.